Hello and welcome to a special episode to conclude season one of our Methods mini-series at Light. Politics, lifestyle, entertainment, history, you name it, there's a podcast Q&A for it. So we thought, why not us too? I'm Robert Averies and I've recruited the help of some members of the Light research team to answer your questions. Thank you for submitting your questions. Let's start with the first one, which is for Izzy. How should ethics be addressed whereby each participant is a co-researcher and co-author of the project?
Thank you, Robert. So when each participant is a co-researcher and co-author, it's important to begin to develop ethical protocols together with all participants from the outset. This includes things like informed consent, confidentiality and data privacy. It's important that you maintain an ongoing dialogue with the participants you have as co-researchers. To include them as co-researchers, their voices need to be considered of equal value and they must be involved in decision-making at all stages of the project. Setting time aside for formal meetings, regular check-ins can help facilitate this. Other things you may want to consider are the different views, backgrounds, knowledge of each participant in the group and what this may bring and how this could influence the research and the group members. For example, there may be power dynamics that you need to navigate and overcome. It may also be important to consider epistemologies and positionality of each of the researchers.
In relation to the epistemologies that collaboration involves, it's useful to remember the reasons why we're collaborating and inviting people into these projects. There are good epistemic reasons to invite collaborators into our projects. They bring new perspectives and fresh eyes and challenge myths or preconceptions we might have. So ethically considering these epistemic consequences of collaboration should be as much about actively pursuing these epistemic reasons that drive us to collaborate in the first place as it is about minimising harms.
Yeah, I agree there, Matthew. I think that's really important. And I think it speaks to the wider point that, and this has been occurring throughout the series, methods that you use and ethical considerations are so closely connected and woven together. And it's not just about synthesizing them and making sure they fit, but it's about making sure one informs and improves the other. Fantastic, brilliant. We'll move on to the second question, which I believe you're going to be answering, Lucy, which is, how do I create a safe space for participants?
Yeah, I think this is quite a broad question, so I think it's worth breaking down, but it is quite relevant at the minute because just this week, some institutional priorities for inclusivity and accessibility have been published, and one of them is create psychologically safe spaces. So it's quite important at the university at the minute. This is defined as creating learning spaces where students feel safe to be themselves during classroom conversations. But this question, I think, is referring to participatory research, which can be defined as the practice of establishing ground rules and guidelines for conversations and behaviours, which it's useful to think about that in relation to broader inclusive by design arguments and inclusive environments more generally. But I think it's just good to flag that there are tensions with this term, safe spaces. I think that we might argue that space is never truly safe, because it's complex, it's not a neutral kind of container. There's a lot of negotiable, contested relations that build up space. And naturally, that is going to lead to conflict, right? But conflict is okay in situations like participatory research if managed with care. It actually means that new shared meanings can be developed and new ways of being can emerge. I think one of our fellows, Barbara Kempf, has kind of acknowledged this in her work. She's got a Padlet on her fellowship about group work where she highlighted resources on managing conflict and advice to reframe conflict and normalise it as something in research. I think that in this case, it's okay to say safe space. I would maybe advise aiming for safer space or braver space, because actually the binary of safe and unsafe is probably unhelpful. We can't guarantee it as researchers. We can aim towards it, but in promising safety, there's a bit of an ethical consideration to be made there. However, it's still important to maybe aim towards safer spaces. So I think a good place to start is maybe building trust. That's kind of the big thing to aim towards. It's kind of looking at the vulnerability that comes from situations where participants are sharing parts of themselves for the research and harnessing that. So without overstepping, so I'd probably take story circles as a good example of this. That's a participatory method where a small group create space for sharing and learning from different people's perspectives. And one of our previous fellows, Jenna Isherwood, she has a toolkit about this, and she goes into principles that create a safer space, in my opinion. A lot of them align with the things that Izzy was saying before. That's just good ethical practice. But one of the main things that she did, and I'd probably recommend as a starting point, is to maybe co-create guidelines with participants at the start of the research, whatever that method may be. So this might look like speaking from your own experience, participating at your own comfort level, listening for understanding and not judging. And maybe making that or allowing that to be recorded in a way that participants can access it throughout the exercise, whatever method it may be. And importantly, it's up to the participant to hold themselves accountable, but also everybody else in the room. So I would say that.
Brilliant. Thank you. A couple of quick reflections from me, Lucy. Really like that you tried to normalise that it doesn't have to be considered, can't be considered fully safe.
Mm-hmm.
It's about being safer and addressing those tensions and being transparent with yourself and with participants.
Yeah.
I also like that you mentioned story circles, because that's a nice synergy with the first episode from this series. What you were saying about creating trust with participants or with students really resonates with what Rachel was talking about in her episode, but also in her on reflective blogs, but also her wider fellowship on building trust with students in reverse mm-hmm. mentoring, and more generally in staff-student partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
And there are loads of ways you can do that. I'd really recommend listeners check out Rachel's work for ways mm-hmm. of building that rapport with students, whether that's in a piece of pedagogical research, as we're discussing today, or more generally when working in partnership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to also acknowledge that there is an intersectional element as well, and for some people, like, achieving safety is going to be a lot different depending on where you're from, background, that kind of thing. But actually, it's the facilitator has quite an important role there in managing the guidelines and making sure that people feel comfortable. And yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's move on to the next question, and this is a really, really interesting and relevant question that we've been talking about a lot recently. The question is, I'm about to conduct some pedagogical research and plan to gather data by an in-person workshop, but I'd like to expand my data set with a broader survey. What generalisation factors do I need to consider? And Matthew, I believe you're going to pick up this answer.
Thanks, Robert. So I think this draws together some of what we've already been talking about in these questions. Generalizability is how well our current research equips us to talk about new situations where some part of the experiment or circumstances have changed. We can think about this in terms of how representative different aspects of the experiment are of some broader group, and what might change when the situation changes. One approach to this is to break it down into questions about the setting, the treatment, the sample, and the measure. So the setting is the context the experiment is happening in, and all the extraneous factors that might be affecting our results. In this case, they're both happening in the same year, at the same university, perhaps at different times of the year, and one online and one in person. So we might expect very broad external factors are probably relatively similar, but timing in the academic year and online in person might affect the students' responses. The treatment is what we actually do in the method. In this case, what does the workshop or the survey offer in terms of the data? Will the workshop make people feel more comfortable, or will the lack of anonymity affect the responses I get, which the survey might preserve? So for some topics, anonymity is going to matter a lot, while for others, the timescale to build trust will matter much more. So the sample asks how we might understand the population of respondents and the ways these may or may not matter for the questions we're interested in. Like, are these populations representative of other broader populations, or will their responses represent something a bit more unique or idiosyncratic? While sort of numbers of responses can offer some security here, it's important to still be careful about asking these questions, because not all effects are going to be distributed in a way that's easily addressed by simply increasing the sample size. Measurement generalizability tends to look at the type of data you've gathered and the ways that data gets packaged or coded. Here we should be asking if you've got good reasons to generalize from like a high Likert score in our survey to a positive discussion in a workshop. How neatly do these different types of measure capture the same underlying phenomenon? So in terms of what this looks like in practice, we look at our research through each of these different lenses and then do good, transparent research as we would whenever any other questions come up. What can we find in the literature about the relevant effects here? In what ways is this research tapping into something being representative of broader effects? And then give evidence to justify our levels of confidence in the generalizations we draw when we arrive at conclusions from our data. So we find data about the effects of timing in the academic year, the importance of trust building in workshops, the effect that having, say, mostly first years respond as participants, and the reliability of, say, Likert scores relative to a long-form discussion. And we justify some of the generalization moves we make. In all these cases, it should be emphasized that what we're doing is making these moves explicit so that we can see our research as part of an ongoing, broader conversation, thinking about what will or might or should matter in other contexts will help us respond to the fact that our classrooms are not universal, they're not homogenous, they're not always predictable, and they're part of a global learning experience.
Thanks very much for the answer, Matthew. And I think those four lenses are a really helpful way to take a step back and reflect on why you're expanding the data set. My second reflection is towards the end when you were talking about the wider context of your research, and that it's not about seeing your research in isolation, it's part of a wider conversation, a particular place, a particular moment in time. That made me think of, and this is going back a little bit, but to Paul Ashwin's keynote in 2020, Student Education Conference 2024, when he spoke about these collective bodies of knowledge and trying to see yourself as someone playing a really important educational role, but an educational role that is embedded within wider communities of practice. So that for me is a really helpful reminder to place your research in that wider context, which we obviously do when we think about literature, we think about what the issue is, but as on an ongoing basis, as you continue to carry out your research, to keep that at the forefront of your mind.
Absolutely. It also ties together some of the community considerations we have when we're conducting research, and the sort of good epistemology, the sort of really considering those questions seriously and like they matter. They're bigger than just what will happen in my classroom this year. It's asking something about how this is tying into something larger that's going to affect these students for a lot longer. It's going to affect the life of the university for much longer as well.
Great. And further to that, Matthew, we recently held a workshop with New Light Fellows where we explored both generalizability and reflexivity. Could you tell listeners a little bit about how you consider the two to work in tandem? Is that the right way of putting it?
Sort of, yeah. I think they're closely related concepts or approaches in research, and I think they're sometimes seen as being in tension, because the more reflexive you are in your practice, the more you're considering yourself a participant in that research, the more involved you are in it, the less someone else is able to come in and sort of go, okay, I can pick up your piece of research and stretch it to this new circumstance or understand it in this new context. I think that's really a benefit of thinking about generalizability in terms of these lenses, is it means we can then start asking, okay, but are we really getting at an underlying phenomenon here, which might only be accessible if I'm being properly reflexive in my practice? If that's the case, then what we might say is that actually it's going to be more generalizable by being reflexive, And what we'd then encourage is that if someone else is trying to do something that's going to generalise this piece of research to a new context, that we might encourage them to take up that reflexive practice in their own approach, because that's where the method is going to link into the underlying phenomenon that we're trying to get at.
Brilliant. That's a really nice way of getting us to think about these two things, reflexivity and generalizability, that are often seen as at odds with one another, but actually to take a step back and consider talking about tensions earlier, Lucy, and mm-hmm. how they might interact in a more positive sense. And should probably give a little bit of background briefly to reflexivity. This is something that came up in a couple of our previous episodes. Lucy, you've created a resource on it.
Yeah, I created a resource just to help researchers really understand more about what reflexivity is and kind of just to think about themselves and what they bring to the research more centrally. In the resource, I define reflexivity as the continuous, collaborative, multifaceted processes through which the researcher self-consciously evaluates how their subjectivity and their context influence the research. So it takes a position of subjectivity being inherently involved, and I can see how that's a big consideration when we're thinking about generalizability as well. But yeah, my research, it's kind of a brief overview of what reflexivity is. It goes into how it differs from reflection, and there's also like thinking prompts and different types of reflexivity, such as methodological reflexivity and ethical reflexivity for people to consider. And then there's also some practical steps to actually use resources to help you embed it within your day-to-day, because I think that's really important, rather than just sort of thinking about it after a research project has happened, starting from the beginning and making it kind of a thorough and pervasive feature of all the research.
Fantastic, thank you. And we'll provide links to that resource and any other resources we draw upon today in the show notes. Fantastic. Let's move on to our final question then, and we're circling back round to Izzy. Are there any methods or advice around interviewing pre-university students? Are there any resources that created by others who have done this?
Thank you, Robert. So the first place to start will be to navigate the ethical issues surrounding this age group. I know we've talked about ethics a bit already in this podcast, but here the students are much more likely to be under the age of 18, and therefore you'll need to have a lot more considerations. They will be considered potentially a more vulnerable group. You'll need to gain consent not only from the participant themselves, but from a parent or guardian. There may be some safeguarding protocols that you may need to adhere to, as well as all the usual ethical considerations, anonymity, the power dynamics, data use, etc. So it's really important that you spend lots of time going through that ethics, gaining that ethical approval as the first step. In terms of considerations around methods, certainly more creative methods can work well with this age group, such as interviewing using photo elicitation, drawings, crafting, constructing with Lego. There's resources on the internet around Lego Serious Play that you could incorporate to make the interview more engaging and less intimidating. You may also wish to consider how you can make the students feel more comfortable. Obviously, the creative methods is one way. You might want to interview in pairs or small focus groups. This can be particularly helpful in some circumstances if students already know each other. When planning the interview protocol and the questions, you'll consider the language, materials carefully. You don't want to have anything overly academic or abstract. Really try to speak in their terms. It could be helpful if you could speak to maybe their teachers, run some ideas by them, gain ideas and advice that may help facilitate these things. A discussion with the teacher or someone that knows them better could give you an idea of what would and wouldn't be suitable in certain situations. In terms of resources, there isn't specifically anything that's been created by others from Light, but there's a couple of websites we'll link in the show notes that you may be interested in browsing. So we've got the ERIC project, which is ethical research involving children. Further links for the university's website at Leeds, which has got a lot of different links around research integrity. And then in terms of methods, we'll link up the National Centre for Research Methods, which has got lots of videos and advice on creative participatory methods with young people specifically.
Thank you very much for that really comprehensive overview, Izzy. Really, really helpful, I'm sure, to listeners. To add to the first section of your answer, talking about informed consent, and this is an additional link I can share in the show notes, some gov.uk guidance on, firstly, informed consent more generally, but then also in particular relation to working with under-18s. And what struck me was that how we think about informed consent on a basic level is the same whether we're talking about under-18s or adults, but then there are specific considerations, ways of adapting the core tenets of informed consent to under-18s. For example, you would always ask in a consent form whether your recruitment materials and information documents make the reason for the project and the reason for participant to be invited to the research clear and digestible. But then there are particular considerations you want to bear in mind when you're aiming that towards under-18s. So using potentially pictures or digestible language. And again, in any informed consent process, you'd want to ensure that participants know they can withdraw. Whereas with under-18s, you might want to check in more regularly than you would with an adult to ensure that they know they can withdraw during the research process, where those power dynamics may prevent that from occurring. So there are those core tenets, as I say, that need to be applied and adapted to under-18s. But then there are also additional safeguards, like you say, with gatekeepers, guardians, and also ensuring the consent form is written not for the person who's potentially signing the document.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that although you have to gain some consent from a guardian or a parent or someone, it's, like you said, it's always important to consider that the actual participant is the student or the young person, and they need to have all those rights as well.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And thanks, Lucy, Izzy, Matthew. We've reached the end of our methods Q&A. And thank you, listeners, for following our methods mini-series. We hope you enjoyed it and you learned something new about pedagogical research methods. We're back with season two at some point, I said it. In the meantime, hit subscribe to ensure you don't miss out on upcoming Light Bites or Enlightening Dialogues episodes. Please send any additional pun-related ideas to the Light inbox. Take care and see you next time.